Today we get to finish the book of Judges, and I've looked, it's been 16 weeks that it's taken us to get through the book, and we have a lot to cover today, so I'm starting maybe a little bit early so we can get it all done and completed in time. And we're starting in Judges chapter 20. And if you remember, last week we ended with this situation in the book of Judges where the men of Gibeah were extremely immoral and ended up murdering the concubine of the Levite. And that's where it was left. But that's not where the story ends. I mean, that's where we left it off at the end of chapter 19. This disgusting thing that happened in the nation. And we're going to see it has lots of implications. It has lots of things that happened because of that. And none of them are really good. But we'll see what happens next. Because starting in chapter 20, we see that outrageous sin of Gibeah had become a national event because the Levite had taken his concubine, cut her into 12 parts, and shipped her with messages throughout the land, so everyone knew what happened. And so what happened, it's this land is going to erupt into a civil war with the tribe of Benjamin right smack dab in the crosshairs of the nation. And there was a national outcry over what had taken place. So if we look at the first 7 verses of Judges 20, we'll get to start to dig into this. Then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. So the people of Benjamin went on. And the people of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this evil happen?" And the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house against me by night. And they meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. So I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here." So now this event that happened is known throughout the country. All the people from Dan to Beersheba is a way of saying that all the tribes were included. And they met at Mizpah, which was a watchtower. And there were 5 watchtowers in the country, and this is one of them. Probably the watchtower used here was the one within the boundary of the tribe of Benjamin. But what we have here shows that while the tribes are all doing their own thing, they still have some alliance to each other. Even though they're desperate, they're disparate is the word, I didn't say it right, they have an alliance, and here they join together after hearing and to some extent seeing, because they saw the body parts that they got, what had taken place in Gibeah, which was in the land of Benjamin. The Israelites gathered from north to south before the Lord in Mizpah. One commentator said the degree of collective outrage may be seen in the gathering of 400,000 soldiers. The Levite was invited by the tribal leaders to tell his story. His shortened version told the basic facts. The men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house intending to kill me. They raped my concubine and she died. But there are distortions and omissions from what they were told as well. You're always going to tell the side of the story that's going to make, you know, them believe you, right? So Gary Phillips went on, he commented on that. He says, first, he omitted any reference to his family problems, without which none of this would have happened in the first place. Why did his concubine leave him and go to her father-in-law for 4 months? Second, he made it sound as though Gibeah was his intended destination, omitting any mention of ignoring advice to stay in Jerusalem or stay at his father-in-law's house a little longer and not wait till the very, you know, the day was mostly over before he started to leave. Third, he inflated his personal danger by claiming that the men of Gibeah intended to kill him. Technically, they intended to ravish him, but not kill him. Fourth, he omitted the fact that he traded his concubine's skin for his, and that he was the criminal, or at best the coward, who thrust her out the door instead of himself. Additionally, he went on and says, the focus of this abridged version is entirely on himself as the aggrieved victim. I, my, me, my. You know, that's what he talks about. He concluded with a challenge to the Israelites to speak up and give your verdict. From this point, the Levite disappears from the story. Yes?
Question, not to focus on the gruesome side of things here, but what is the intent or the purpose of dismembering and sending? I don't understand that.
The purpose of it was to spread that message throughout the land so something would be done. That was his way of announcing it.
It inflamed everybody.
It was inflammatory.
One thing, but the bloody body parts.
He wanted to make it as poignant and as gruesome as he could, so everyone would buy into his side of the story. Because he wanted revenge on the Gibeahites. Yeah, pretty gruesome way to do it.
Yeah.
So that's where we're sitting right now. And this was not a small gathering, 400,000 strong. Now there are some, just to let you know, there are some who suggested that understanding the word used for thousand, it's elep, was a military unit, thus meaning 400 contingents or 400 military units rather than 400,000. We don't know, but it was significant. It was significant. The function of such large figures throughout the Old Testament, when they say elop, you know, whether it means a thousand or just a unit, is one commentator says it's frustratingly evasive. But what this does is it does tell you there was an overwhelming response to sending those parts out. And they had to send them with a messenger. You don't just send them. Oh, who'd this come from? I don't know. You know, there was a message that went with it.
Like an attached note or something.
Yeah, yeah. There were messengers that had to go with it and say, this is what happened, you know, and here's proof of it. Just send me a picture. I don't need the body part. But anyway. Another commentator said, 400,000 seems like a large figure if taken literally can mean the total population of Israel was more than 2 million. Perhaps elop should be interpreted as contingent. in which case the number could be reduced to as low as 40,000 minimum. We'll find out it has to be more than that, but it's a lot, any way you look at it. It's a very significant number. And there's a significant response to what we see that they in their response, starting in verse 8. And all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up to against it by lot, and we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 of 1,000 and 1,000 of 10,000, and bring provisions for the people, that when they come up, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. We see that twice. We see it in verse 8 and we see it in verse 11. United as one man. The response of the people was in unity. They probably should have done a little more probing of the Levite, but they didn't, or at least we're not told that they did. And the reaction was one of rage and justice against those of Gibeah. And it was a grossly immoral act that the people of Gibeah did. They were bent on repaying, as we see in verse 10, they are bent on repaying Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage they committed in Israel. Now, you might think of that as an extreme position, but turn to Deuteronomy 13. Deuteronomy 13, 12 to 18 states this. This is part of the law that they, some of them would have known about anyway. If you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men, I thought that's interesting because that's what the people of Gibeah were called, worthless men. Some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom you have not known. Then you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. If it is true and the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it, and its cattle with the edge of the sword. Then you shall gather all its booty into the middle of the open square and burn the city and all its booty with fire, as with a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God, and it shall be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. Nothing from that which is put under the ban shall cling to your hand. In other words, don't take it as booty. Don't take it home. In order that the Lord may turn from his burning anger and show mercy to you and have compassion on you and make you increase, just as he has sworn to your fathers. So the reason this was given in Deuteronomy is to honor the Lord and purge the stuff that's there. Now, anything we see here in Judges 20, were they doing this to honor God? We have no indication that that was their motivation. They were incensed in what took place in Gibeah. They were united and bent on attacking and punishing Gibeah and laid out plans to do so. And they were united as one man. And I got thinking about that. It's too bad they couldn't have been united as one man in driving out the Canaanites as they were instructed to do. But they united against this outrage.
Hey, Bruce?
Yes.
They were united with one another, but it doesn't seem like they said, okay, let's go before God and see what he wants us to do. Where's God's role in this at this point?
Yeah, we're going to get to that, but that's a very good point. They haven't sought God. We have no indication that they sought God and said, what should we do? It's like, we're incensed, let's go get them. Yes?
I'm still struggling with the motivation on the part of this guy. He didn't seem to care about his concubine. Mm-hmm. So So it seems to me he benefited by not being around anymore. Why is he making a big deal out of it and bringing it to the attention of everybody?
Well, that we're not told. We're not told what the motivation of the Levite was. We are told that when he, after 4 months, when he went to his concubine, he spoke tenderly to her. Maybe he cared for her. But, yeah, we don't see his motivation. It wasn't one to pull them back for their sin. We don't see that. Don't know. Did you have a question?
No, I just keep thinking about Paul. When he said, he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And then keep saying about, they want to get vengeance. And it's sounds like Pharisees, you know. I'm just trying to make the connection because it's, interesting to me. They're wrong. You shouldn't be killing people. And then the way he, let his concubine go, and he's a Levite, it's just, screams hypocrisy.
It does. It does. And it's interesting you bring up Paul because we're gonna bring him into the story in a minute. Yes.
It seems to me like it's part of the Israel culture to have respect for the remains of the body. And
that's true.
This guy didn't show any respect for the remains of a dear one.
Mm-hmm.
It just blows me away, that concept.
Yeah, that's not anything we can relate to.
Yeah.
You know, and would we take someone who was treated that way and cut it up in 50 parts and send it to every state in the union to see if we get everybody excited about it? No, you know, but it worked what he wanted to do. It got everybody excited. Yes?
One of the things that I was thinking about is why they let a few men kind of run what happened, and then I thought about every man was able to do what was right in his own eyes, and this was, nobody was going to tell these guys they couldn't do this wicked thing. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, this whole concept of doing right what is right in your own eyes, and then these people getting together and say, we're going to go after the men of Gibeah because they did what was wrong. You know, it's kind of like what Scott said in the sermon this morning a little bit. People want to do what's right in their own eyes, but if you bring up murder, is it right to murder somebody? Probably nobody would say that. Mm-hmm. Well, until you get to pro-choice. Well, we'll just call it something different, you know. But all kinds of thoughts go through your head when you read this thing.
Mm-hmm. You wonder kind of what the original Benjamin, the son of Jacob, he was a favorite, right? Wasn't he the last, the youngest, and was a favorite son? Remember how the brothers protected him and the father protected him?
Well, they protected him because what happened to Joseph.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you wonder what kind of a man he was, and to think that this tribe with his name turned out to be these kind of people, you wonder what he would have thought of
him. Probably not been too pleased. Now, and I think, Larry, you started with this. Unlike the earlier chapter 1, if you go all the way back to chapter 1 of Judges, where the tribes asked God to see who was to lead the attack on the Canaanites, here there is no indication they sought God for counsel on how to proceed against those who were in Gibeah. They planned the order of their waves of attack based on the casting of lots. They planned the logistics of the supply lines for the provisions, and their plan in brief was an attack on the city of Gibeah in order to, quote, give them what they deserve. And you can bet the emotions were high. They had to be just through the roof. They were going to avenge. But then we have a little bit of a change in verse 12. We read, and the tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among you? Now therefore give up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. Okay, so they went to the men of Benjamin. They went to the tribe and said, give us these guys that did it so we can kill them and get rid of this evil. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a reasonable request when you look back at it. Who are the ones that did the evil? The men of Gibeah. So they need to be punished. But then we have the last half of verse 17. But the Benjaminites, I had to practice saying that one. The tribe of Benjamin is the Benjaminites. And it comes up as a spell check error every time I type it out. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. So before they marched on Gibeah, they went to the tribe of Benjamin. I sent a group to went there and said, hey, hand over these guys. This is what they did. They made it clear what their intentions were. We're going to put them to death. How many of them were there? We have no idea. There were several. And the remaining tribes were right in going to the leaders of the tribe of Benjamin. But the answer they received was not only disappointing, the answer they received from the tribe of Benjamin was wrong and sinful. They should have turned them over. Because that's what was stated as law, as justice, as just in the law of God. They would not listen to the voice of their brothers. And you have to ask, why not? Maybe because they were indifferent to the story of the crime. Maybe they didn't believe it. Perhaps they already had built up an animosity between the tribe of Benjamin and the remaining tribes. You're not going to tell us what to do. Who knows? We don't know. Whatever the reason was, it was strong and defiant. And they were willing to go to war over it. I was talking with my granddaughter just a few days ago and about the whole list of reasons people go to war. And she said, war is stupid. War is bad, you know. And I think about the reasons that they were willing to go to war over this and kill people. I'm going, why'd you do that? And I got thinking about real stupid reasons people go to war. And the one that really came out to mind to me was the whole cause of World War I. If you go out and Google what caused World War I, and I did it after I talked to her, I wanted to make sure I was right, it'll say there's still a lot of confusion as to what caused the war. Historians don't know. They know the facts, you know, that the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, and that just caused this. The basic underlying reason, from what I remember from studying it a little bit, is they were looking for an excuse. They wanted to go to war. The Austria, Hungary, Germany, France, Russia, I mean, there were a lot of times they were called, they were different countries back then. They just wanted to go to war. And they did. So be able to claim their own interest. And we need to not lose sight of this, that there was 20 million deaths and 20 million casualties in World War I. 40 million people impacted. That's a lot of people. For what reason? They can look back 100 years later and go, we don't know why they went to war. One thing about it was not because of environmental concerns. You ever heard of mustard gas? But whatever their reason was to go to war, and again, in World War I, and we could go to lots of other wars, it's another demonstration of the depravity of man. And despite anyone had done in the past, or has done in the past, No one has or will be able to stop this depravity, stopped this war, either on a local, national, or international level. That is until Jesus Christ comes to set up his kingdom. We've all heard the little joke, you know, in Miss Universe pageant, what do you want, world peace? Oh, yeah. Why can't we get it? Because of man. Until Christ sets up his kingdom, that's going to be a problem. The Antichrist is going to set up a pseudo-peace for a little while, but it's not going to last. Back to our text. I'm sorry, I got off on a little tangent there. So, they went to Benjamin and said, give us these guys. And here's their response in verse 14. Then the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities of Gibeah to go out to battle against the people of Israel. We are going to go to war with you because of this. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, and besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men. And among all those were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. In other words, they were proficient at their trade. And the men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered about 400,000 men who drew the sword, and all these were men of war. The people of Benjamin against the other 11 tribes, just to protect those in Gibeah who had grossly, immorally sinned. Interesting, great marksmen with the slings and stones. Now, this is well before David and his sling, but it was something that was done. And apparently these men were willing to give their lives for the, quote, worthless fellows of Gibeah. Now we finally see in verse 18, for the first time, the 11 tribes go and inquire of the Lord. First time. And the people of Israel rose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God. But their inquiry is interesting. Who shall go up first for us and fight the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. It didn't say, shall we go up? That decision had already been made. Who shall go up first? And interesting, too, the question was not asked to Yahweh. If you look at the word there, it's Elohim or God, who is the generic name for God, not the covenant name of God. And Judah was chosen to go first, which makes sense because the victim of the sins of the men in Gibeah was the concubine of the Levite from Benjamin, and the concubine was of the tribe of Judah. We see that in Judges chapter 19, verse 1. So now we have the first battle. First battle takes place in verses 19 to 23. Then the people of Israel rose in the morning in the encampment against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin, and the men of Israel drew up battle against them at Gibeah. The people of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. But the people of the men of Israel took courage again and formed a battle line in the same place where they had formed it on the first day. And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until the evening. And they inquired of the Lord, shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, go against them. So they lost 22,000 men in the first day of battle. That's a significant thumping. And I'm sure that wasn't anticipated by the 11 tribes. We have all these people. We've outnumbered them a bunch to little. And we don't know what Benjamin lost, but we know that Israel lost 22,000. And then we see their reaction in verse 23. They wept before the Lord. Then they inquired again if they should go fight the Benjaminites. And they were told, yes. And so the 11 tribes were still intent on continuing even after the disaster of the first battle. Now, one thing you might have noticed, if you read real slowly verses 22 and 23, the order seems a little odd. Many commentators think that over time these two verses became inverted, and actually verse 23 should come before verse 22. It just flows better if you just put that above it. It doesn't change the meaning of anything. It's just kind of odd just how it's written out. But then we go to battle number two in verses 24 to 28. So the people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin the second day. And the Benjamin went out against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 of the men of Israel. All these were men who drew the sword. That's the description of the battle. Then all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. And they sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days, saying, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And the Lord said, go up tomorrow, I will give them into your hand. So day two, battle number two, 18,000 more men died. So we have 40,000 men at this point in time that are dead. That's significant. And after the defeat, they gathered at Bethel and wept. And they're fasting toward the Lord. So they're finally turning to God. They fasted and offered offerings before the Lord. And the offerings were to serve as seeking atonement from the Lord and seeking the Lord's forgiveness or acceptance. So when you add up the losses of those first two battles, you have 40,000 men who have perished. And these were the good guys, weren't they? Going against the people who were protecting the evil guys. David Guzik wrote this. He said, perhaps something of the same dynamic was at work with Israel at this time. God correcting a disobedient nation through the tragic loss of the soldiers of Israel. Because Israel wasn't really following God at this time either. The 11 tribes weren't following God as they should have. So the two defeats took away them from trusting in themselves. Guzik went on to write, God used this to humble the whole nation. They had to understand that the horror of the crime at Gibeah was not merely the result of the sin of one group of men or one city or even one tribe. The whole nation had to be humbled because they first thought that the sin problem was only in Benjamin. Israel had to see that the nation as a whole had a sin problem. You know, it's very easy to think, for me, and I would guess you too, it's very easy to think that sin issues lie elsewhere when we look around. All the issues facing today's church. And before we get too involved in pointing out the glaring issues of others, it's always best to look inward and make sure that we deal with the sin in our own life and our own heart. Jesus pointed this out in Luke 6, in 41-42. He says, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye when you do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, brother, let me take out the speck that is in your eye, when you yourself do not see the log that is within your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck that is in your brother's eye. And we have to be careful of that. You know, it's easy to look down and go, oh, boy, those guys, they need to not do that. We need to make sure that we're looking introspectively too, that God is dealing in our hearts. Now, one positive we see coming out of this, 14,000 deaths isn't very positive, but one thing that positive we see is they turned to the Lord after the second defeat. They didn't stop seeking him, but they intensified their seeking him, as we see in verse 26 to 28. They intensified their repentance with fasting and sacrifice to the Lord. And I thought, was thinking also, isn't that kind of how we are? We far often we get serious before the Lord when we're in more trouble than we're not in as much trouble. Until we get into that, boy, we really need the Lord, then we turn to him, and interestingly enough, he's always there. He doesn't say, why didn't you come earlier? I'm done with you. He doesn't. But we have this sinful tendency to rely on ourselves. How backward is that? Isaiah 55, starting with verse 6. I started with verse 6. I thought, this is a great verse. And then I kept on reading it. And I thought, I got to go further. Seek the Lord while he may be found, and call upon him while he is near. That's verse 6. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, and he will have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout, and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word which goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire, without succeeding in the manner for which I sent it. For you will go out with joy and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills will break forth into shouts of joy before you, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush, the cypress will come up, and instead of the nettle, the myrtle will come up. And it will be a memorial to the Lord, an everlasting sign which will not be cut off. What a great passage of Scripture. I hadn't read that for a while, and I thought, oh, that feels good just to read it. But the last thing to note is the message from the Lord after the second battle. This is the only time that he told them that they would be victorious. Only time. He said, Judah lead, Yah go out again. But he didn't tell them they would be victorious, but he told them they would be victorious after the third battle. I will give them into your hand. And the people didn't question it. Well, you didn't do so good the last 2 days, Lord. They didn't question that. They said, okay. So they're learning to depend on the Lord more, as they should. Then in battle number 3, this is the first time we are told that there is a battle plan and what that plan was. And this is, 19 verses, and I don't know if we'll read all of it. We'll pick out parts of it as we go through. But it says, in verse 29, so Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah. And all the people of Israel went up as against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah as in other times. And the people of Benjamin went out against the people, were drawn away from the city. As at other times, they began to strike and kill some of the people on the highways, which goes up from Bethel to the other to Gibeah. And in the open country, about 30 men of Israel. And the people of Benjamin said, they are routed before us as at the first. Here's the difference. But the people of Israel said, let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways. And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Baal Tamor. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place from Meragibah. And there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all of Israel, and the battle was hard, but the Benjamites did not know what disaster had came upon them. Verse 35 is very critical. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and all the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. all these men were men who drew the sword. And so we have some narrative with this battle, how it happened. And when you read through this, it will remind you probably or possibly of the plan against Ai that we went through in Joshua chapter 8 when they ambushed the city. They pretended they were getting beat. The men came out, surrounded them, and destroyed them. And with the two fresh victories, the Benjamites were full of confidence, and we saw that in verse 31 and 32. And confidence often leads to defeat. Then, of course, the Benjamites were unaware that the Lord had promised them victory. And nothing really could have happened to stop the victory from happening because God had told them they would have that victory. Verse 35 is a very critical verse in this battle. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. Again, it was not the ambush, it was the Lord. Now, the conclusion of the battle was a complete and total victory for the Israelites. And if you do the math, our math professor isn't here today, so he can't question my math. But the tribe of Benjamin started with 26,000 men of war. And if you read through this, sometimes there's different numbers in here, but if you go to verse 46. So all who fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men who drew the sword, all of them of valor, and that's just a rounded number, but 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon and remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. Okay? So you had 26,000 men who started, and you had 600 that survived. Now, according to my math, that's a 97.7% fatality rate. Less than 2.5% survived. The vast majority of Benjamites were gone. 600 men. And you could read more of the details of the battle in the verse 37 to verse 47. But with time constraints, we're not going to go there. But when you count all that, we have 65,400 perished because of maybe 25, 50, or 100 people, men of Gibeah, who were grossly immoral. The conclusion is devastating, as seen in verse 48. And the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, the city, the men, the beasts, and all that they found. And all the towns that they found, they set on fire. And this goes back to what we read in Deuteronomy. They were following that prescription. Sin has horrible consequences. And here is just one more example of the horrible consequences of sin. And now we had a real problem, though. Now we got a real problem. There's only 400 or 600 men of Benjamin left in the tribe. In the whole tribe. That's not very many. So we start in verse 1 of chapter 21. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, "Not one of us shall give daughter in marriage to the Benjamin," or to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel, that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel?" So after the slaughter, the vast majority of troops were gone there for Benjamin. He had 40,000 casualties on the winning side. He had 25,400 on the losing side. There are a lot of people that lost a lot of family. And so they cried out, why did this happen in Israel, that there should be one tribe lacking? Of course, the answer was because of the sinfulness of man and their refusal to follow the commands of God. Had they followed the commands of God, as Joshua told them, as Moses told them, this would have never occurred. So the answer was because of our sin. And they, I got to believe most of them knew that, but they still asked that question. We kind of know it. Why did this happen to me, Lord? Well, maybe because you sinned. So with about 400 men left in the tribe, or 600 men left, and the sworn statement that no one would allow their daughter to marry any Benjaminite, how were they going to have any kids and prolong that tribe? The tribe could easily be wiped out. It was on the verge of becoming extinct. Now, how important is the preservation of Benjamin to the nation of Israel? Well, you ever heard of King Saul? Mm-hmm. King Saul came from the tribe of Benjamin. You ever heard of Esther? Esther's uncle Mordecai? He was a Benjamite. Very possibly Esther was. We don't know for sure. And then, as Chris alluded to, you ever heard of the Apostle Paul? The Apostle Paul was a Benjamite. So, is this important that God maintains his tribe? Yeah, I think so. I think so. So verses 4, we go on. And the next day the people rose early, verse 4, and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly of the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he will surely be put to death. And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin their brother and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? So they understood the situation. So they went again to Bethel and offered sacrifices to the Lord. It says they had compassion on their brothers. They realized something needed to be done. One commentator said, apparently the participants at that gathering have taken a second oath that similarly comes to bear on the present predicament. In addition to withholding their old women from the Benjaminites, the Israelites have agreed that the severity of Gibeah's crime has made participation in the tribal assembly mandatory. In other words, if you didn't come up with these 11 tribes, if you didn't come up with this, then we're going to go after you too. You've got to be with us, or that's how serious they took that whole thing. As a result, he goes on, as a result, the entire community has sworn that any group failing to attend will be put to death. In spite of the enormous ongoing complications created by such decisions, both the absolute importance of the spoken word as well as the solemnity of a vow prevent either oath from now being rescinded. Now, this happens many times. When people commit to something, they fail to think through the unintended consequences of what they said. We could say that about 80% of the laws passed by our Congress. But yeah, they try to fix this, and oops, and that's what happened here. We do it all the time. Now we have a serious dilemma, and they're trying to find a way to resolve it. Now, coupled with that that's taking place there is, we need to look at Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 to 10. It states there, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside of the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So this was part of what was part of the law. So from this section of the law, and it goes on through verse 10, but we see that Israel was to place value on keeping a man's name from ceasing to exist. So you can imagine what it would be if we have a whole tribe whose name ceased to exist. It would be a tremendous impact. So in verse 8, they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. So when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation set 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also their women and little ones. So the consequences of this sin isn't going away. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with them. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. So they went, destroyed Jabesh-Gilead because they hadn't joined them, and then took these 400 young virgins to say, okay, you guys from Benjamin, you 600 guys, here's 400. We've taken care of two-thirds of you. So we see here that the civil war against Gibeah, it expanded to the Jebusites for their failure to join it. And it doesn't go into the specifics of the slaughter, but what a mess. This is an absolute mess. Gary Phillips wrote this: biblically, men are to be protectors, not abusers of women. But biblical priorities were turned on their head in the days of the judges. The question of how these young women might feel about being orphaned from their families and harvested, I like how he used that word, harvested for enforced marriages is ignored. Yeah, what did those 400 people think? It's ignored. Verse 13. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon. Remember, they were there for 4 months. And proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned home at that time, and they gave them the women that they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. But they were not enough for them, because there were 600 of them. So there's 200 of them that didn't win the lottery. I'm not sure that's why how they did it. I have no idea. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. So they were given these women that they took from Jabesh-Gilead. I have no idea how these people processed this. You had the men of Benjamin who their whole culture, their whole lifestyle had been destroyed. The cities had been burned. Everything they had been destroyed. They survived. And then you had these 400 women whose whole town is wiped out. Oh. What a. You know, the Bible doesn't sugarcoat stuff. It just tells you how it was. And sometimes it wasn't pretty. But again, it shows the sinfulness of man and what he does. Now, it's interesting, in 1 Samuel chapter 11, I told you that King Saul was a Benjamite, right, from the tribe of Benjamin. In 1 Samuel 11, we sing that King Saul protected the people of Jabesh-Gilead against the aggression of the Ammonites. And perhaps Saul's protection to protect these people went way back to the event that he knew where his great whatever grandmother came from. He had a compassion toward the people of Jabesh-Gilead. Then verse 16 to 24. Remember, we still have a couple hundred that do not have wives. Then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters, because they vowed against that. For the people of Israel had sworn, cursed be the man who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they said, behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, south of Lebanon. And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go, lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh, and go to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man his wife in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty. And the people of Benjamin did so, and took their wives according to their number from the dancers whom they carried off, and they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man and tribe to his family, and they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. Quite a story. Again, you probably have never had a sermon preached on that one. Yes? I'm not sure I know the answer to that. There's so many tangled lines in this, the whole thing. You know, I don't know. But so they needed to gather more women. There were more, I call it, more resources were gathered. That's the term they use in business, more resources. In reading through the passage, many questions are left unanswered. These include, one, were those in Shiloh unaware of the events that led to the tribe of Benjamin being short? Two, were those women Canaanites or Israelites? We're not told. I'm assuming Israelites, because if they were Canaanites, would they be considered for marriage? Three, what was the response of the fathers in Shiloh whose daughters were taken by the Benjamites, or the Benjaminites? I mean, Bressinger says this, nothing suggests any resistance or hindrance whatsoever. Instead, the Benjaminites seize their wives, return home, rebuild their cities, with countless people stampeded in the process. The pressing problem concerning the potential extermination of the tribe of Benjamin finds resolution. As a result, Israelites find that they can finally disassemble, head home, and perhaps rest easier. So these actions prove to be effective in maintaining a tribe of Benjamin. But they were strange, at least. And we're going to see historically that Benjamin is going to side with Judah after the reign of Solomon to create the southern kingdom. And all the other tribes go to the northern kingdom. And then we have the end, the last verse of the book of Judges. And you might say, oh, that's familiar, because it is. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, the book ends with the same note that had been stated throughout the book. It was not a problem that Israel had no king. That was not a problem. It was actually a good thing. But the problem was that the laws of God did not preside over what was viewed as right and wrong, and everyone did what was right, quote, in their own eyes. And we don't have to look very far to see what doing right in our own eyes brings. Truth. and what was right in Israel had become relative. And you see it on a daily basis, all the way through the book of Judges. And this is exactly what our Western culture has done. I throw all of Europe into that whole thing too. But with one major difference I see today. Many want truth to be relative. I have my truth and you have your truth. But for those whose truth is grounded in Scripture, who calls out right and wrong, our truth becomes hated, not tolerated. I have my truth, you have your truth. But if your truth says my truth is wrong, then I'm intolerant. Of course, you could spew out stuff. We have to take out the hatred of Islam toward Christianity and Israel, and the pro-choice people who promote the murder of babies in the womb. These are examples of groups that are completely intolerant of those who do not accept their truth. Just after I wrote that paragraph, I got on Facebook, there was a posting out there, and I saw this, and I thought, whoa. In a sermon, this is a very, very, very recent sermon, preached at the First Christian Church in Katy, Texas. Katy is just outside of the city of Houston. Quote, this is in the sermon. One thing you must remember in this life, you're here to do one thing. Live in your truth. Unquote. That couldn't be more demonic and more blasphemous. Now, the preacher was a drag queen. And they're saying that in church. But that's what's being promoted. Living right in your own eyes doesn't work, because then you're living in your truth. You're creating your truth. You're saying what's right and wrong. We must seek to do what is right in God's eyes and to worship Him, as it says in John 4:24, in spirit and in truth, God's truth. And then we have 1 John 1:5-7, and we'll end the study of Judges with this verse. This is the message that we have heard from Him and announced to you, that God is light, and in Him there is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with Him yet walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in light as He Himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus His Son cleanses from all sin. Let's make sure we walk in truth, in God's truth. Let's pray.